You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Nikita.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
No, focusing on one day at a time, one foot in front of the other. How about you?
That's all you can do in this crazy world, Nikita. And usually that doesn't work, but we do our best. And let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. Do your end of the year rate and review. Hit pause now and do it. Unless you don't want to. You're Nikita Petrov, member of the Non-Zero team, but also proprietor of the Psychopolitica newsletter, where your certainly distinctive and possibly unique worldview manifests itself on an irregular basis. Is that, or is it regular? Do you have a regular publishing schedule?
It's starting to become a little bit regular after a long hiatus.
Is it? Good. So people should seize this opportunity while the regularity lasts, because you never know in this crazy old world.
I am streaming regularly now with Boris, who was on Non-Zero as well.
Oh, yeah.
And we're doing
I've
it like
email
every
from Boris. I was traveling, so I haven't read it, but I will.
But yeah, we're starting to do it regularly. Like every couple of weeks we stream, and now we're actually starting to publish the things that we stream. So like we've done maybe 10 episodes where it's live, but then if you missed it, then you missed it. Now we're starting to publish the conversations, and they start to, you can see the contours of the conversations become more defined. So I'm
so
pretty excited.
So if you missed
about
it,
that.
you didn't miss it. If you missed it, you didn't miss it now.
Now it's like that, yeah.
Right. So see, that's just an example how crazy this world is. That's a flat out logical contradiction to say that if you missed it, you didn't miss it. But that is the world we live in, folks. And that's the world we're going to make sense of, Nikita. We're going to talk about what era we are living in. This was your idea. And you said, hey, it's end of the year. Why don't we try to define the era we are living in? Let's take, say, the last 5 years. What's been characteristic of that? And I said, Nikita, you're not thinking big enough. This is not just the end of the year. It's the end of the first quarter of the century, A. True. B, it's the first quarter of the first century of the millennium, okay? I don't know about you, but I may never see a threshold of this magnitude again, depending on whether AI advances so rapidly that death ceases to be a human concern.
Right. Next year aliens land and AI merges with us completely and the threshold is just like right around the corner. That's a possibility.
Nikita, AI is an alien landing, okay? This is the metaphor we got to go with. Here's the metaphor. Okay, go ahead, and then I'll tell you what the actual metaphor is. Take a shot at the metaphor.
There's an interview with David Bowie that I think back to with some regularity. I think it's in the 90s, and they ask him whether he would become a musician if he was, you know, young, like a teenager at the time of the interview. And he says, probably not, because the reason he and people like him got into this rock and roll business, it felt subversive, explosive. You could change the world maybe with it. And now music seems like one of the career choices. And so he says if he was a teenager then, he would probably become a computer programmer or a hacker or something. Have you heard about this thing, the internet? And he uses that specific metaphor. He said, like, we don't even know what this is. It's not a computer network. It's an alien intelligence that landed on this planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my metaphor, which, by the way, I trot out in my forthcoming book, The God Test, about AI, is it's like aliens are approaching. We don't know if they mean good, if they have good or bad intentions or what. That probably they can be negotiated with. They have reason to think they can be negotiated with. But if we're going to successfully negotiate with them, we have to, first of all, get united as a planet. You know, we can't say, sorry, we'd love to talk to you, but we're too busy fighting wars among ourselves. No, mm-hmm. You got to get your shit together, focus, because AI, I mean, technically speaking, what I'm saying is that AI challenges has a lot of, well, one thing I'm saying is it poses a lot of policy challenges that can't be addressed at the national level. But it's the argument for planetary unity, as always, is even stronger than that. That's the idea. But anyway, so I have, you have a candidate for what age we are living in? Is that,
I have. So the reason I said, let's look at the last 5 years is that feels like, and just on a, even if I'm not asking that question, if we're not having this conversation, hey, what is the era we're living in? It just feels that in 2020 with COVID, something changed and nothing has been normal since. It's like the last 5 years are a blur of weird shit happening. And it's a combination of world events, things happening like more locally, like, you know, the war in Ukraine, my life, I got uprooted and left the country, etc. But I think back to COVID these days, because it's like that was such a intense, unexpected, worldwide event that we never got on the same page about. Everybody had experienced it in some way. There were quarantines and illness and death, but also, you know, PCR tests and people wearing masks, travel restrictions, new kind of borders appearing on the planet where, you know, depending on what access to which vaccines you got, you could travel to different places or and couldn't to others. And that was restricted. So if you're in Russia, you couldn't get the Western vaccine. So you can't travel to Europe because Russian vaccines are not accepting Europe. There were so many things happening and it was all so slippery. We still don't know there's not a consensus about the origin, the threat level. And so it was this intensely weird time that never kind of got resolved, I feel. And then it just segued into what to me feels like a blur of intense, unexpected events. So that's why I'm giving this 5 year frame as a beginning. Is just to me, it feels like that. I'm not saying this is the best candidate rationally, but the global quality of the pandemic and you know, it started. There's like a moment when it starts. I think makes it a good candidate for where a lot of people would feel shit got weird. Or things changed in a serious manner.
It definitely did get weird. Now, I immediately, of course, shoehorned it into my own favorite paradigm, which is, I already alluded to, which is like the number of issues that really require international governance that we're not yet tackling at an international level. I don't just mean that, obviously, we didn't really have all the international mechanisms in place for handling a global pandemic in a coordinated fashion. But the, you know, now I think most reasonable people acknowledge that there is at least a significant chance that it was a lab leak. You can, you know, there's evidence on both sides, but it could well have been indeed a genetically engineered virus that escaped from a lab and killed millions and millions and millions of people. And, you know, it's funny now that that is the conventional wisdom, pretty much, or at least now that a lot of people accept that. Nobody, I can tell, talks about what seems to me the obvious implication, which is that, you know, this whole biotech thing, it's not enough to regulate it at the national level. And we're not, and apparently we're not doing a great job at the international level. We don't have it under control. And there's just a growing number of things like this. I've been making this argument for decades. And I think AI is gonna be like a times 10 multiplier of these things, but it, in a kind of diffuse sense. But so that's my takeaway. But I would to return to kind of yours, it definitely had, you know, a very big impact, obviously. it was, you know, on the one hand, it was an accelerant in the sense that there are some things that would have happened anyway that happened faster, like remote mm-hmm. work. You know, we're moving, you know, to a world where certainly it's possible to do more and more work remotely. I mean, you know, in the course of COVID, some employers discovered that actually there are they argue there are virtues of having people physically together. I mean, who'd have guessed that if you let people work from home, they'll spend more time fucking off, you know? Although, a weird thing about the online world in general is that it makes it so easy to fuck off at work when you're physically at work.
Right.
You know, it's funny. This weekend, I was in Washington, and one of the people I saw was my old boss, Mike Kinsley, who had been the editor of the New Republic when I was there, late 80s, and then I stayed through the kind of early mid-90s, and man, what a different world. I mean, when you were in your office, you know, you had no access to information. I mean, beyond physical books, magazines, newspapers in your vicinity, that was it. You could call people, you could blah, blah, blah. But first of all, that led to a lot of the kind of workplace synergy. It's like if you needed feedback on an idea, a story idea, right. Go into the next, you know, office and talk to somebody and bounce off. Totally, totally different world. So COVID accelerated some things. Simmering sources of despair for younger people, by which I mean people in their 20s and so on. Now, AI has famously accelerated that or intensified that by raising questions about whether there's going to be any work for the ones who are, you know, kind of white collar, college educated, especially. I do think it kind of contributed to that. And then little things, right? Like it legitimized wearing masks. And now a number of like mass shooters have taken advantage of that, right? Sure. I mean, who knows if, and not just mass shooters, who knows if Mangione, who knows if he hadn't had the, you know, the mask option, he would have, thought that he could get away with it. And maybe wouldn't have done it if he didn't think he'd get away with it. You know, same with this guy who killed both the students at Brown and MIT. So there's so many weird little things you don't even think about, as a result of COVID. What else do you want to say about the
I
idea
mostly
that COVID was a game changer?
I mostly think about it in terms of this kind of breakdown of a consensus about what's going on. Like, mm-hmm. I thought back to this memory. You remember Sasha? He was did a little work yeah. for us, my friend. I met mm-hmm. with him. I forget when it was. I guess must have been early in the pandemic in Moscow, and we spent some time. We're like walking around the city, talking like a normal day, and then we're entering. We're gonna go to a store, and you had, I think, like it was mandated. You're supposed to wear a mask as you enter a grocery store. And I had mask with me. And so that was my kind of routine. Like you're about to enter a building, you got to put right. on a mask. So I'm doing that. He's putting on a mask and gloves. And to me, that seemed like over the top, weird kind of measure of control. But of course, there were people for whom masks seemed that way. Mm-hmm. And there were people for whom leaving the apartment is reckless. And we never got on the same page about it. And it's the issue that we're talking about is like physical danger, you know, to the level of death possibly. And it's like where, you know, two people are leaving the apartment. It's as if like one thinks the world is so dangerous, I need a bulletproof vest if I leave the apartment. And the other mm-hmm. things, it's totally overblown and there's nothing to worry about. And within one friend group, you had people ranging, you know, everywhere on that range. And like that was just kind of weird. But then if you think about, since none of this got resolved, there's not a consensus about all of this. Like, what did Putin think about COVID? What does he think about it now? He had this approach. He never was seen, I think, wearing a mask, but he went through the period of isolation where if you saw him talking to somebody, it was across these very, very long tables. He would do, there were these like church services where there is nobody in the church but him. What did that do to him? You know, what is his theory, whether it's a lab leak or not? And if it's a lab leak, was it intentional or not? And there's all of these, you know, takes that you can entertain about what was happening. There's not a consensus about it. I feel like there's not a conversation about it. It's kind of like it just happened, like a weird dream. And then we segued from that into a new world where more things are moving. I mean, for me, it's like there was COVID and then the Ukraine war started, and there's just like no pause between these big events that keep you moving and keep you guessing what tomorrow is going to be like.
Yeah, it was so strange. I mean, I remember going into New York City and it was just like the streets were empty. And now, you know, pretty much back to normal, but I agree that the residue remains in ways we don't totally appreciate, probably. But I also think, you know, it may well be a kind of glimpse of the future if we don't get our shit under control. I mean, we're just headed for more, you know, catastrophes. Because, again, technology is making more different kinds of catastrophes possible. Right. And I can enumerate them. And the world is no closer, so far as I can tell, to taking that seriously and saying, you know, maybe we should get together and like agree on like a system for monitoring labs, for example. And like if a country won't submit to this kind of transparency, there are certain things they don't get. Like they don't get access to certain kinds of, I don't know, you know, whatever, maybe relevant materials. You know, that's the way the Chemical Weapons Convention works. And it's one of the few of these international agreements that has any teeth whatsoever. The Biological Weapons Convention doesn't. But the Chemical Weapons Convention at least says if you don't sign on, then we will not. And, you know, it is signed by the overwhelming majority of nations. OK, that's important. But it's like if you don't sign on, it is not legal for any of us to export to you certain chemicals that you need in industry. And so there, I mean, I hope I've got that right. I think I do. And you need something like that in this room, but nobody's, I mean, it's just mind blowing to me how it's just, we're a bunch of fucking apes. It's like China bad, China bad, China bad. It's unbelievable. And this is like the finest minds at our think tanks, you know, These are the people prepping to go into the next Democratic administration. They're fucking apes. Go ahead.
The COVID thing, like on the surface of it, like it's a biological problem, right? And it does not respect borders. Like it's a virus. It's going to be everywhere. And it did get everywhere. And you might think that would lead to a realization for more, like more global cooperation is needed. Like we need to be able to solve these problems together. But it worked kind of the other way around, it feels like. There is less trust rather than more of different actors to one another. That vaccine thing, I mean, there were, in America, from what I hear, there was this internal pretty intense polarization on the vaccine question and the mask question. But what I think about when I think about vaccines is this international thing where it's like, again, on the surface, it's a biological problem. We just need, everybody needs ways to deal with it. Can the world figure out how to make a vaccine quick and distribute it? But what ended up happening is there's a competition for markets for these vaccines. There's these conversations for like ostensibly the reason Russian vaccines were not available and recognized in the West is because like they don't trust the scientific process there and there's not enough publications or something. And then the same in the other direction, like if you live in Russia, you can't get a Western vaccine. It's just the Russians that are available. And there are countries where you can choose from all of them. And there are countries that were just trying to get something. And what they would, you know, dependent on business deals and power politics, I guess. But it ended up creating a new sort of map of the world, you could imagine. You know, there are like national borders, but if you think like who can travel where in that period when COVID was at its height and vaccines were starting to become available, it's like if you live in Russia, you're not going to be able to go to Europe because you don't have access to vaccine that is needed to be able to cross the border. But you can travel to these other countries that use the Russian vaccine. And so suddenly there's like almost like a Soviet bloc reemerging against all political wishes. Funny. It's not a dynamic that was, it wasn't visible. It wasn't there for everybody to see like that bloc reemerging in a new way. But you'd throw this one thing, this accelerant, as you say, on the planet, and suddenly these formations become visible.
Yeah. No, it's and you know, one thing there is that there are, you know, I say like, well, we should all get together and cooperate, solve these problems. But there are genuine zero sum dynamics among nations. It's like there's a finite number of masks. There's a finite, you know, there are vaccines. There are various resources that, you know, access to which is a zero sum game among nations in the short term. So it's a very complicated problem how you respond to something like this in a way that reconciles the zero-sum and non-zero-sum dynamics. And that's why you got to think about it in advance, you know, and figure some shit out and establish some institutions and some rules of the road. So it's not at all a trivial problem. And it's not a great mystery that the world didn't come together as one because this was right. In some sense a threat to the whole planet. It's the reason you got to be thinking about this stuff in advance. But are we really thinking about it? Look, I acknowledge there are people that we don't know about off somewhere, including at think tanks and including, you know, at the UN and various places who are giving thought to this. How do we handle the next pandemic? But still, you know, by and large, in the establishment and certainly the foreign policy establishment, there's nowhere near adequate thought being given to the world we're heading toward, where not only is this kind of thing, you know, this was going to become more and more problematic anyway, just as biotech spreads, technology advances. And AI, you know, is already exacerbating this specific problem, you know, Anthropic, the first model that merited biosafety level, I think it's 3 that, anyway, it was the first model to merit some level of, you know, some biosafety label came out early this year. And then later one came out where, should we move this up to 4? And they acknowledged in the report that it wasn't clear they didn't. But they acknowledged that this was, you know, this in principle posed a graver risk than the other one. Now, it may mean it's probably the case that what they mean by graver risk is like not in its ordinary operation. But if you jailbreak it and get it to do stuff it's capable of, I assume that's what they mean. But anyway, jailbreaking is pretty easy to people who are determined. I mean, a lot of kinds of jailbreaking are. It's pretty easy to get these things to do what they're not designed, what they're supposed to not do, if you really put your mind to it and know what you're doing. But again, was that a story in the New York Times? I don't think so. It's like focus, people. So I have a candidate for the age we're
living. What's your candidate? I'm assuming AI is going to feature in this, right?
Well, it is, but you know, it's more subtle than that in a way. Because it's not just a large language model era. This was triggered by thinking of this in quarter century increments, mm-hmm. and thinking, well, what can we say about the past quarter century? And here's my candidate. I haven't thought this through. This was an initial response to your email from last night. And I may drop this thesis immediately, but I think you could call this quarter century, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe the algorithmic age or something, but what's characteristic of it is that it's when machines, we started letting machines direct our attention, okay? So a social media algorithm is AI driven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Facebook was founded in 2007. Mm-hmm. At first, it was not algorithmically driven, but increasingly it came to be. And I will say, I think from early on, the ads were algorithmically driven, probably before the news feed was. For that matter, Google's ads were probably driven by machine intelligence early on. In any event, you know, this problem is obviously, well, assuming you consider it a problem, a challenge, let's call it a challenge, is going to grow more acute with large language models. You know, you're going to have these, at least a lot of people are going to have like their favorite companion bot, and it may come from a big company that has to make money if they're going to keep making companion bots. And one way they make money maybe is an advertising model. And just as nobody from Facebook, you know, pops up on your screen and says, by the way, you're being shown this ad because of XYZ. And by the way, one reason they don't do that is they don't know. That gets back to what I'm saying. The algorithm, you know, the machines are making the decisions. They don't, you know, I used to say, like, why do we dictate transparency of algorithms so that we'll know what the algorithm is steering our attention on Twitter and Facebook, you know, not to ads, but to content. Part of the answer is nobody knows what the algorithm is. That's right. The way machine learning is, just as nobody knows exactly what's going on inside an LLM. And this is what I mean, is like the age where if you ask, like, and of course, advertisers have always tried to steer your attention. You know, I mean, 50 years ago, nobody said to you, the reason you're seeing an ad for jewelry is because you're subscribing to the New York Times, and the jewelry company knows that the New York Times has a readership that has a lot of money. But first of all, you could probably figure that out. And in any event, somebody knew that was the answer, right? That's why this was being directed towards you. But for the first quarter of this century, we started moving to a time where nobody knows. We just invent these machines and tell them to optimize something, and they optimize it. And that's going to get weirder and weirder. So that's my nominee. I don't know. It's not, the algorithmic age doesn't do it justice. We need a better, you know, the age of algorithmic attention or something. Or no, 3 A's, algorithmic attention age. I mean, it's all, you know, then there's also, you get it mixed up with AAA, you know, the auto thing, but.
Well, it's interesting. You can define these eras as, here's a thing that happened and the consequences of this thing, the algorithms are proliferating. Or you can look at the consequences and it seems like, there's like what I said about COVID and what you're saying about these algorithms. The same dynamic seems important to both of us, which is this breakdown of a consensus reality and people getting information streams that are created for them. And we don't mm-hmm. even know how and by whom, by these mm-hmm. machines. But so that would be another way to frame it. Like what is, it's, whether like it, nothing started at a particular moment, right? It's not like COVID was when things started with AIs, you know, there's LLMs, but you can point to the creation of the iPhone or the first algorithms for ads or the internet. You can trace it back however far you want. There's a blurry line there. But what are the dynamics that seem important? And one of them, it seems like we agree, is this bifurcation, this shared reality breaking down into multiple custom-made, tailor-made realities that are seeking engagement from the user, from the consumer of this vision of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a good point about. I mean, it's hard to draw the lines. The internet itself made things weird. And by the way, you know, the World Wide Web barely became a thing before this quarter century. I mean, again, Mike Kinsley, he founded Slate in 1996, almost 30 years ago. And at that point, that was like the second general interest magazine on the web, kind of. The first was Salon. And it was all brand new. And the things do all, you know, it's hard to figure out where to draw the lines. But the world has changed a lot. And I've just never understood this argument you hear from Peter Thiel and Tyler Cowen. I guess maybe they've become less vocal. But as of a few years ago, it was like, we're in an era of technological stagnation. I'm just thinking, are you on drugs? What the fuck are you talking about? I mean, I've never closely examined the arguments, but I have theories. I don't know about where the confusion lies.
The kind of like when you said this just now, it made me think of like somebody's cocaine high is starting to wear off, or they feel like it might start to wear off. So they're like, we need to get higher. You know, it can feel like that if you're addicted and you're
I wonder, that's actually a very interesting metaphor. Yeah. It's like, anyway, I think things are moving fast enough for pretty much everyone now. I don't know. How widespread would you say is agreement with me that this AI thing is like for real and it's going to have a huge impact in like in your circles? And also, how much has that changed over the last 6 months, a year? My sense is it is changing pretty rapidly. And the number of people who say, okay, this is going to be a very big deal is growing. I'm not sure many people agree with me about how big a deal, but what's your sense of the change?
I mean, what I hear is everybody's more or less on the same page that it is important and a big deal, but there hasn't been enough time for people to wrap their minds around this. And I feel the same way. Like, I don't know what it's going to look like in 5 years, in 10 years. I'm open to possibilities, you know, ranging from all of our consciousness merging because some Neuralink type thing that works telepathically and doesn't require wires gets introduced and we get vaccinated with nanobots. And just reality changes forever. You know, maybe nothing like this happens. But as you say, what we've got now is already plenty weird, and I think we haven't even caught up with that. Like, what technology that already exists, what consequences there are going to be with this? I was just looking at some article. I forget the numbers, but some high number was thrown out as the percentage of AI music on streaming services and in the charts, like on the streaming services.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, I guess, like in this year, we're at the end of 2025, with the AI stuff, that is the most distinct kind of change that that got my attention, and I still haven't figured out what I think about this. The proliferation of AI music and how hard it is to tell sometimes an AI song from a human made song. I played a little bit with the app. That's trippy. And what that means for creativity, for like music to me is more, it shaped me so much more than like the visual arts. You know, I have favorite painters, but it's not anywhere close to being 13 and listening to your favorite album.
Right.
And now, what does it mean if, you know, 50%, 70%, what is the percentage? Is it going to stop the proliferation of this music? And if it doesn't, what does it mean that the music we're listening to is machines creating stuff that is just addictive or, you know, hits the particular zone that keeps you playing?
I mean, you could argue that at that level, it won't matter much because, you know, the music industry has always been about finding things that we would get addicted to, just like whatever. They just want to sell shit, you know? It's right. Like, what'll work? And then there's some constraints, like, you know, big, powerful companies are kind of responsive to the establishment. And so, I mean, especially in an age where it's easier to control content. And these come and go. I mean, in terms of how easy it is for the establishment to control content, we see it kind of goes up and down. There's no single long-term trend. But to the extent that that's the case, that is a constraint. You know, there were certain, even in the 60s, when the protest scene picked up in the late 60s with Vietnam and everything, you started hearing kinds of songs you'd never heard. There were songs you didn't hear. You didn't hear songs advocating the bombing of buildings. I'm sure somebody wrote one. I mean, you almost did. Gotta Get Down to It. Soldiers Are Gunning Us Down. That's a lyric in Four Dead in Ohio about the Kent State shootings. You know, so it's in that sense, you know, it's always been shaped very heavily by the demand side. That's us. That's what kinds of music we want. And then some constraints constraints will continue to apply both by, you know, the establishment in the broader sense and in the sense of, like, you know, specific interest groups that are powerful and control big chunks of media and so on. So you can argue that's not really going to change. But if it's a world in which human beings can't make a living creating certain, you know, when people are moved out of the thing entirely, that has implications at the level of employment. Now, in the case of music, you know, people have made the argument that you're going to see more value placed on, like, in-person, you know, appearances, small local things. I think that's probably true. I would also go ahead.
Well, I was about to say there is the music I pay most attention to now is Russian music, and part of the reason is it now, since the beginning of the war and more restrictions on what's allowed and what's not allowed, it became this high stakes thing again. Just now, there's news. There was this band that was playing in St. Petersburg, just like street musicians, and they made their set consist mostly from songs of these foreign agents, like people, musicians that are branded as foreign agents, who are all outside of Russia, and not every song is explicitly banned, but it's all this like. You know, you're not supposed to be spreading this. And they played regularly in the street in St. Petersburg. Bigger and bigger crowds started gathering, singing the song together. And then they got arrested. And they do this thing. There's a tactic that they do where you get a 15 days sentence. As soon as it ends, you're detained again and you get another 15 days and then you get another 15 days. And so you just don't know how long it's going to continue. So these, this girl and the guy went through this. I forget how many days in total they ended up serving. And then finally they were let go and they left Russia. And now they're on stage with these really well-known musicians whose songs they were playing in St. Petersburg. Uh-huh. And is this, you know, hugely emotional moment for the crowd, the singers, the less known and the better known people, but it's all high stakes. So that, you know, AI is not going to play a huge part in that dimension of things.
Right.
But there's still something. This is what I'm saying. Like with this music thing, I haven't had enough time to think about what it means that this medium that is so intimate, uh-huh. like it affects you so directly, is now being crowded by the machines.
Yeah. So we should probably move into overtime. I want to say more about this, and then there's other stuff we're going to talk about. I also want to talk about, if you're talking about quarter centuries, I want to talk about, you know, the quarter century almost began with the 9/11 attacks. And I think more broadly, even in a certain sense in Russia, I might argue that roughly a quarter century encompasses the era when terrorist attacks triggered pretty massive responses, or kind of put fuel on that fire. I mean,
if you're talking about Russia, quarter century is exactly the beginning of Putin's period, right?
Yeah. He came a couple of terrorist events, one of which, well, we'll get into that, whether the KGB was behind the bombings
theory
that justified deeper intervention in Chechnya or something mm-hmm. like that. But we'll get into that. Let me say, so overtime is for paid subscribers of Non-Zero newsletter. Easy to become one. And you go to Non-Zero, and then you can either just watch the rest of this there, listen to it there, or go ahead and set up your podcast feed so that you will always have easy access to the overtime segments. And there's almost always an overtime segment. I would say 90% of our podcasts have at least one. And they go on for a while, and we really let our hair down and just say crazy shit. Stuff we could get canceled for. We could get canceled for the stuff we say. So the more you hate us, the more you should want to, have access to overtime, record it, and then use it to destroy our careers. That is my key end of quarter century recommendation, is that people really get serious about destroying my career. I mean, look, it's obviously pretty largely worked, okay? But I just say finish me off, like
by clipping the most outrageous little bits and spreading them on social
Absolutely.
Media, asking every friend to please spread it further because this guy needs to be taken down.
That's right. My business model is to charge money to people who want to kill me and then let them do it. How's that sound? But seriously, folks, don't kill me. And also, rate and review, right? I'm getting serious about this appeal, Nikita. The rate and review thing. It is too often said in a rote way. And I don't, I almost never say it at all. So I haven't been saying it at all. And then people, for people who say it, it just sounds, it has this rote quality. You say it the same way every time. And that's the case for not saying it too often. But when you say it emphatically, right, Nikita?
That's correct. People should. Do you read the reviews?
I read the reviews and the ratings. I read the stars. I do. And one reason, like if you go to Apple Podcasts, when I decided we needed to get serious about this appeal, is like if I go to the Apple Podcast site, which is one place you can rate and review, you can also leave a review at various podcast app, I guess Spotify, I guess. Certainly, if you like us, I assume that helps in the Spotify algorithm or something.
I mean, the best thing, I think, is, the place where you can actually make a difference more easily, I think, is YouTube. And there, like, leave a comment, start a conversation in the comments, argue mm-hmm. with somebody in the comments, argue with us.
Smash that like button. Argue with us. Bring it on. it does help. It really helps. But I was going to say, when I realized, I've been doing this so long that I have a respectable number of reviews at the Apple Podcast site. But then when I go in and look at the reviews, I realize, you know, they're not accumulating at a super rapid rate. And so I guess I should become one of those podcasters who encourages people to do it. Because it actually genuinely does help, I think. I mean, I don't know what determines, which podcasts rank higher in the discovery algorithms that steer people's attention toward these things. That's my whole point. We don't know how these things work. That's the age we're in. But I got to think it helps if you give it a positive rating and or review it. So anything else before we go into overtime? Nick, are there other things we're going to talk about in overtime?
Well, we haven't talked really about what happened this year.
Yeah.
If we look at the 25 years also, there's like shit that we missed. I mean, to me, I mentioned in my email.
As Mickey would say, don't leave it in the locker room. No, actually, he says that before we even press record. But the point is, you should just tease like a two-word tease, like sex and drugs. Is that what you're talking about? Sex and drugs?
Yes. We're
going to talk about sex and drugs. Plus whatever Nikita was going to say. What were you going to say?
Political dynamics in Russia in the last 25 years. Eras started and ended within that 25-year period.
Yeah. There's plenty, and we'll just go off on the tangents for which we're famous. So join us in overtime. But thanks to everybody who's listened or watched this far, even if you don't, and we will see everybody, next time.